Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 146, What Keeps You Up at Night? It's always reassuring to know that there are two sides to the space science community. There's people who worry about Hubble tensions and all the other cosmological models that might or might not be right. And on the other side, there's the people who worry about whether we'll all die tomorrow.
Dear Cheap Astronomy, just how good is our planetary defence? The issue of planetary defence is a genuine thing these days. Where, for example, NASA has a Planetary Defence Coordination Office, the PDCO. According to the PDCO, there is no known asteroid larger than 140 metres that has a significant chance of impacting Earth over the next 100 years. However, the key word there is known. The PDCO also note that as of December 2024, there are 36,765 known near-Earth asteroids over 1 kilometre in diameter, and they estimate there might be another 50 yet to be found. Anything over 1 kilometre is getting into mass extinction territory, where the Chicxulub non-avian dinosaur-ending asteroid is thought to have been about 10 kilometres in diameter. We've been worried another one might be due about now, but that modelling has since been refined, and we currently think the frequency of these large impacts is more like once every 250 to 500 million years, so there's some reason to feel a bit safer, although if we did spot one on a collision course tomorrow, that would just be statistically unlikely, not impossible. All these predictions are just based on averages, where we're assessing the record of known impacts on Earth and the Moon to determine likely expected frequencies in the future. Anyway, we are now tracking the large majority of asteroids that could potentially wipe us out, and none of them look like they're going to for the next 100 years or so. That's good, although there's still some unknowns. As the PDCO noted, it's likely there are still a small number of killer asteroids we just don't know about yet that could still appear out of nowhere. This might be because they have low albedos, that is, they don't reflect much light, or they're on unusual orbits and we just haven't spotted them yet. And there are also comets to worry about, objects that may have orbits way out past the frost line near Jupiter's orbit, which are hence either covered or composed of ices that start to melt off into a tail as they approach the Sun. We know about and are tracking a lot of short-period comets, but we may still be surprised by some long-period comets that we just haven't been aware of previously. And some comet nuclei are bigger than a kilometre, and hence could be as mass extinction-inducing as an equally large asteroid. So, it's best to never feel completely safe. NASA's PDCO coordinates US planetary defence efforts in cooperation with space agencies of other nations through the International Asteroid Warning Network, essentially a bunch of observatories around the world, as well as the Space Mission Planning Advisory Group, a bunch of bureaucrats from different countries, at least some of whom are associated with the European Space Agency. So the Warning Network keeps an eye out and collects astronomical data, while the Mission Planning Group makes plans for what to do in the event of an impending impact. Assuming things get serious enough to require deflection of an object's path, there are some options available, at least on paper. Kinetic deflection seems the favoured approach at the moment, perhaps partly due to the success of the DART mission in 2022, which did successfully adjust the trajectory of the 180-metre asteroid Moon Dimorphos through kinetic impact, which means the DART spacecraft crashed into it. The Mission Planning Group also oversee regular scenario building. That is, they pretend an asteroid is coming and then decide what to do at the annual Planetary Defence Conference. The 2024 scenario imagined the discovery of a 150-metre asteroid heading our way with a possible impact in 2041, which was expected to airburst above the ground over populated areas of Africa, resulting in casualties and deaths anywhere up to the 1 million mark. The NASA JPL Near-Earth Object Deflection app, yes, there is an app for that, was then used to calculate that a sufficient delta-v change to avoid the asteroid colliding with Earth could be achieved by launching a spacecraft able to deliver 600 kilograms of mass and then hit the asteroid at about 8 kilometers a second. What we might do if a greater than 1 kilometer monster was heading our way is still not clear, but at least for now, we have time and technological development on our side.
This is the middle bit.
It is good to know that we take some risks seriously, even if we haven't quite nailed what we're going to do, if those risks ever escalate to reality. But at least we are thinking about it. Anyway, on the other side of space science, we're more engaged in dealing with theoretical uncertainties rather than existential ones. Dear Cheap Astronomy, what do you make of timescape cosmology? Timescape cosmology is built on the idea that time runs differently in different parts of the universe. According to general relativity, clocks will run slower in areas with high mass energy density, and hence gravity, than clocks sitting out in empty voids. This is undoubtedly correct, given the very robust testing of general relativity in laboratories and spacecraft, and through astronomical observations. So although we never have put a clock in a great empty void of the universe, it is safe to say that measurements would show it running faster than a clock in a dense concentration of mass energy like the Milky Way. How much faster, and what the implications of that difference may be, are the key issues here. It's been claimed that the difference in the clock rate in empty voids compared to the clock rate in galactic clusters could be as much as 35%, which is remarkable, if not extraordinary. It's probably safer to say that there will be a difference, but how big that difference is can only currently be determined from mathematical modelling, the accuracy of which depends on the data you have to model with. But okay, for the sake of this episode, let's go with the possibility that the difference in clock rate could be as much as 35%. Now consider this in the context of cumulative time over the history of the universe. When the universe was young and very hot and dense, clocks would have run the same everywhere, but with ongoing universal expansion, creating a cosmic web of dense galactic clusters, separated by great empty voids, clocks have been running faster since a growing proportion of our expanding universe is those great empty voids. From there, though, you have to refer to a lot of complex mathematical modelling, out of which timescape proponents claim that this clock rate differential is enough to explain the Type 1a supernovae data that underlies the conclusion that the universe's expansion is accelerating. So, while all the data we are receiving on or near Earth does clearly indicate the universe's expansion is accelerating, we do have to stop and consider that the data is coming to us from different relativistic frames. Imagine a thought experiment where you are in the Milky Way and your twin is out in a great void. An external observer would receive data indicating that your twin in the void is aging faster than you are in the Milky Way. despite the fact that neither you nor your twin would have any local perception of aging either faster or slower. It's a fundamental concept of general relativity that things will measure differently when you make an observation from one relativistic frame into a different relativistic frame. So if the universe is only measurably accelerating because those measurements are relativistic rather than absolute, then timescape proponents claim you might not need to appeal to dark energy as the driving force behind the acceleration. Conceptually, the idea of timescape is intriguing. At the same time, it's unlikely the Nobel Prize-winning people behind the existing standard model of cosmology had just never thought of this angle before. The current enthusiasm for timescape in the science blog community largely arises from a 2024 paper. So it may just be that no one in the specialist cosmology community has had the time or the inclination to find holes in the paper's findings and publish an alternate view. There is an existing problem in current cosmology anyway, where we can't reconcile the supernovae data against observations of the cosmic microwave background, where these two data sources give different expansion rates, being the so-called Hubble tension that we've covered in a previous episode. Timescape proponents are yet to show that they can explain away the cosmic microwave background evidence for accelerating expansion. So, for now, as we like to say here at Cheap Astronomy, it's best just to watch this space and time.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. You can worry about whether or not the universe's expansion is really accelerating, or you can worry about life as we know it coming to a quick and abrupt end. It does look like we're pretty safe for the next 100 years or so, but we really do need to keep an eye on the skies. And as for the universe expanding, well, it is, and its expansion rate is probably accelerating too. Although there's no harm in keeping an eye on other theoretical models. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just feel like being expansive, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll keep an eye out for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.